Hello and welcome back to The Bunker, politics and current affairs in daily bite-sized pieces. Today, Labour's endless issues with the flag. In the run-up to the election, Keir Starmer's party has been a lot less shy of demonstrating its patriotism by adorning campaign literature with the Union Jack than its predecessor regime. And by the way, it's perfectly okay to say Union Jack and not Union Flag. The Flag Institute says the idea that it should only be described as a Union Jack when it's flown from the bowels of warship is a relatively recent idea, so I'll be sticking with Union Jack throughout this podcast. Some members of the Labour left are unhappy with this new flag-centric look for Labour. In March, meetings of the party's black, Asian and minority ethnic groups said they were uncomfortable with leaflets that were heavy on the red, white and blue. Some claimed that activists were refusing to deliver the materials, and one Labour MP told The Guardian, for a lot of communities, we're talking about colours that are associated with the National Front or other far-right groups. Unfortunately, the flag seems to be rather popular with voters, leaving the party caught between an electorate that associates the Union Jack with the monarchy, D-Day, the Olympics, or maybe just Noel Gallagher's guitar, and perhaps the remains of a Corbynist base who think that it's an imperialist symbol or the butcher's apron. Can Labour calm down and learn to love the Union Jack, or does it need a new relationship with the national flag? I'm Andrew Harrison, and here to talk about it with me is a person who is healthily disinterested in this stuff. Jerry Hassan is a writer, academic, and co-author of The People's Flag and the Union Jack, an alternative history of Britain and the Labour Party. Hello, Jerry. Welcome to The Bunker.
Hello there.
So first up, as people may have deduced from those two words, you're a Scot, you're pro-independence, you write for the indie site Bella Caledonia. What does the Union Jack mean to you personally? Are you able to be objective about it?
I don't think probably anyone in the United Kingdom is completely objective. I think flags are something that are deeply subjective, emotional, we have relationships with. And I think what I feel about the Union Jack, the Union flag, as you say, is that it is the flag of the state I live in. It is a flag I have a relationship with. And I think what I would try and pose to you is that there's many, many different interpretations of the Union Jack. It's evolved over centuries as well, what it means. It didn't used to be the flag of the state. It was the flag of a monarchical union when Scotland and England came together in terms of the Union of the Crowns after 1603. It then became the flag of state in 1707 when Scotland and England joined as into one state. And it then became the flag of the United Kingdom in 1801. So it's got many, many different meanings through what it has represented. And of course, Britain, the United Kingdom, has changed as well. It was the country of empire. It's now not a country of empire. It was represented slavery and imperialism. The British Empire abolished slavery. And so it's not one thing. And that's what I think is one of the most central tacits we have to get on. Lots of people either say we have to identify with it and feel pride in it, or people feel loathing in it. It is many different things. All those things are legitimate, but allowing for a plurality of meanings is maybe the most important thing, I think.
Yeah, it is interesting that what you described, you know, those are the kind of the high political meanings when the representations of state. But to a lot of us, like, we grow up and it's like, it's the little plastic flag that you wave when you were at school and you might have a warm feeling about it. Or maybe you saw it on Jerry Spice's frock at the end of the 90s and it symbolised the moments in your teenage years. And the idea that a flag is purely a state symbol, it's not, is it? It's kind of woven into, I mean, it's for somebody my age, you know, I find myself thinking of Tim Brooke Taylor's waistcoat in the Goodies. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. I think each generation has its tale of how it comes to the flag and how it understands it. And I think what you've touched on, what you think is really a central point here, is that there's a political and official manifestations of that flag that is the flag of a state, and it's used in, you know, royal ceremonies and state ceremonies and so on. But it also has a cultural set of connotations. And those cultural connotations have changed profoundly as well. And when empire began to recede, which is late 50s into the 60s, what happened was that the flag began to be celebrated by pop culture, by bands like the Beatles, the Kinks, the Who. It was celebrated in terms of how those bands presented themselves in America and so on. And you couldn't have had the flag presented like that without empire beginning to recede over the horizon. They were playing with memory of empire. They were thinking empire was over and that a modern Britain and a modern Union flag could represent it. And that was a great creative period culturally. And we've seen similar, maybe slightly less, you know, important periods through Britpop and so on, and you mentioned Spice Girls. There are other points where the flag has been celebrated by cultural forces in the country.
I've got a Scottish mate, and whenever I say the British do this or the British do that, he's very quick to say, no, the English do that. Why are the English so kind of shy about flying the Union Jack? You know, because we can talk about the Cross of St. George in a minute, but, you know, whenever any of us visit the United States, we see flags everywhere. We tend to go, God, they really like flying their flags. We don't do that at all here. Why are we so kind of wary of it?
This is a big, big, big subject. There is an ambivalent relationship between England and the United Kingdom that is for a variety of reasons. One is that England and Britain used to be used synonymously by a lot of English people and English leaders, politicians, etc. And there used to be an age where, even though it maybe grated on some Scots and Welsh people and Irish, it was an accepted norm. Stanley Baldwin, we're going back a long time here, when he was Prime Minister, used the two terms, English and British, synonymously. So you've got this relationship of how England sees itself in the Union and what the Union flag represents. And previously, the Union flag was used at points to represent England. And I'm talking culturally, not officially. So for instance, when England won the World Cup in 1966, the mascot is in the Union flag, not in the English flag. And lots of English progressives, people on the left, have regarded the Union flag as something synonymous with the right, whether it's Mosley, fascist, the National Front in the 70s. And again, not saying they're in any way fascist, but people like the UKIP party, the Brexit party, Nigel Farage, they have claimed the Union flag as well. So a large part of England, and particularly on the left, but not exclusively, have kind of ceded ground, have seen it's not their flag. And I think that ultimately is a problem, because it has meant that in places, the Union flag is seen as synonymous with the right.
Do you think that progressives in general, particularly the Labour left, have a blind spot in understanding the kind of visceral emotional appeal of the Union Jack, in that large numbers of people want it to represent good things and want to turn away from the bad connotations? You can't have a flag that represents something that has been a global empire without it representing an awful lot of terrible things as well as some good things. But the progressives tend to think that it can only ever be associated with the wrongs that we've done.
I think that is right. This goes to a sense of singular, you know, essentialist interpretations of flags. And I think it's true in both senses. Those that claim who are generally on the right, we should only feel pride and identification with the flag. The mirror images of that is those on the left who are, say, anti-imperialist, who regard the British flag, the British state, as only synonymous with evil, mass murder, violence, the British Empire. And, you know, a common strand of that would be found on parts of the Labour left. People like Jeremy Corbyn represented that version of the Labour left. And it doesn't allow for the fact there are many different interpretations of Britain. Britain has done some terrible things in its past. There isn't really, I think anyway, a great story that can be told about the British Empire and imperialism. It was, like all empires, based on violence and conquest and, you know, doing terrible things in the name of the British state, and again, true of other states in the world as well. But there are other versions of Britain. So, as I said earlier, the state that was, you know, hugely involved in the slave trade and the terrible violence that was also the state that led the way in terms of the abolition of slavery and the slave trade. So there are many things that flag represents. I think one of the things it comes down to, though, is that if you take the French example and the American examples, their flags are identified across the political spectrum because they come from a sense of the Republican traditions, the French Revolution and the American Wars of Independence. And they are seen as flags that have symbolism that progressives can identify with as well. Now, the Britain doesn't really have that as clear-cut a relationship with that on the left and with progressives. So people feel this huge set of ambivalences and therefore feel distanced and sometimes even like disgust at the flag. And I think ultimately that's a problem, because long traditions of left-wingers, radicals, and people who have challenged the establishment in Britain have done so while also identifying with the flag.
When I think about, you know, the issue of patriotism and the flag and how it relates to kind of the natural Labour vote, I always think about my grandparents who grew up in two up, two down with an outside toilet. That's where I would visit them, you know, when we went to see my nan and granddad. And my grandmother would always say, I tried to talk to a little bit about politics in my kind of childish teenagery way. And they were the kind of people who absolutely should have been four square behind the Labour Party. And I would, and this was in the 80s when Labour was, you know, very much in a kind of Corbyn type of phase. And the phrase that stuck in my head was my nan saying, yeah, but they're the anywhere but here party. They don't like us. They don't like this country. And she saw that kind of, you know, she was the archetypal working class woman who loved the Queen. I actually can remember her waving a Union Jack at the Queen when she drove through Liverpool and being almost in tears. And I know that there are a lot of people on the left who would just like scoff and mock at that. But that was very, very real. And all of her mates and all of her friends were like that. Is it an impediment to the left that they just don't get that?
Yes, I think it is 100%. If you have a miserablest, talking down, completely negative view of your country, it impacts on how your message comes across to people who they don't think, breathe politics 24/7, and B, they have an innate identification with their country. Now, that doesn't mean to say that you accept all the warts and all that are in Britain today, the inequality, the poverty, the sheer debased nature of our politics and capitalism. But if you just completely go at the negative side of it and then in a way seem to be like, you know, talking your country down or you be portrayed by the right as anti-British, what I think you do, you cede the idea of Britain and Britishness to your enemies, to the right. And it's also that you miss the fact that there are many, many different versions of Britain. Some of the most radical moments of Britain and those effective radicals have been people who have embraced and articulated different kinds of Britishness, where I think it was Tom Paine, the Chartists, the trade unions of the 19th century, and the British Labour movement at its best. And at times when the British Labour movement has been its most successful, 1945, to an extent Harold Wilson in 1964, they have spoken with an alternative Britishness and even used on occasion the Union flag, because they've thought that is a tradition, Britishness, that we are part of, and we don't buy in completely to the establishment version of it. There are alternative accounts of Britishness, as there should be, and we don't cede that ground to the right. And I think when people do cede it, they've done so at great cost, where I think it was Jeremy Corbyn recently, or a long lineage of more, say, radical and ultra-left elements who have always viewed Britain as synonymous with empire imperialism.
I want to bring it up today and talk a little bit about the kind of the battles that the sort of Labour centre and centre-right has been fighting over this for years. I mean, I'd forgotten, for instance, that Neil Kinnock had union flags on his podium during campaigning. Throughout the new Labour period, this was a very salient issue. Long after the Cool Britannia, Jerry Spicer's frock, Oasis guitar bit, Blair tried to start a debate on reclaiming the flag in the year 2000. Is the spokesman, what the spokesman had to say sounds rather poignant now. It's a little bit of a long quote, but bear with me. For over a century, the Conservative Party has successfully wrapped itself in the flag. By contrast, the left has seemed to have had a blind spot about nationalism, regarding it as an awkward fault in human psyche. Until we are sure about our own British identity, we cannot resolve our relationship with Europe. That's massively ironic. If we can get this right, we can associate Labour with the values and institutions the British people hold most dear and regard as emblematic of Britishness: decency, tolerance, liberty, and fair play. Do you think that New Labour got it as right as a Labour Party has got it on patriotism?
Again, that's a really really nuanced question, because New Labour got many things right and got many things wrong, obviously. And, you know, the Blair prime ministership ended up in tears, and that wasn't just about Iraq. But yes, for a brief period after 97, there was a sense of a progressive Britishness. Well, there was an opening that was a different Britain was possible. There was constitutional reform going on. There was significant social reforms and things like national minimum wage and Sure Start in terms of addressing, you know, really, really trying to address child poverty. And what you tend to get is when I wrote the book you referred to about Labour and Britishness, the points where Labour articulates successfully an alternative Britishness seem to be not that long. There's a period after 1945 in the years of the Attlee government, which is only 6 years. There's a period of early Harold Wilson in the 60s and social reform and so on. And there's an early period of Blair. And it looks like, if you do it historically and you just view the record, that those periods are then lost and the right reclaims its version of Britishness. And Labour has enormous disadvantages in terms of how it articulates Britishness, because A, it has to be related to reality. B, there's a part of Labour on the left that are against us. And C, there's a very, very well-known conservative and reactionary story of Britishness, which speaks to people that people are familiar with. And Labour have never successfully managed to dislodge that for long enough, for the reasons I say, that the conservative version is deeply tapped into emotion, into history, in tradition, into the power of reaction, and how people are familiar with this. People know that, the fact of how power is so dysfunctional and not equal in Britain is something they're familiar with, and they're familiar with that story of reaction explaining it, that basically privilege should continue running things. You know, the fact of private schools, the House of Lords, the power of a certain version of finance capitalism. They're familiar with it, and they're familiar with the story of that going back to the days of empire. And I think it will be a tough ask again for a Starmer Labour government to talk about a different Britishness and to succeed in anything beyond the short term, which I think will add to problems they will have when they already have, you know, enough problems. They don't need to go looking for more, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's coming in just after the Labour leader who is possibly the most hostile to traditional patriotism in, you know, certainly in my memory. I mean, the previous most left-wing leader, Michael Foot, was quite a traditional patriot. And, you know, he fought in the war. But in the Corbyn years, you would see more Palestinian flags at a Labour conference than a Union Jack. Certainly, you'd barely see a Union Jack. Do you think that Starmer is kind of grabbing and using the flag as a way to signal to the rest of the country that we're not like those people?
Yes, I think it's very, very calculated and understandably so. There is a view you could say that when people like Clement Attlee, who fought in the First World War, Harold Wilson, even Blair, when they embraced the flag, they were doing it, particularly in those early years, but not the whole period, they were doing it from some sense of strength, as well as trying to contest that Tory version of Britain. Starmer's not doing it from a position of strength, and he's clearly one of the big undercurrents of it is to differentiate from the Corbyn era, because the Corbyn era really was associated with lots of people with being, rightly or wrongly, with being anti-British and being at kind of war with traditional British values and traditional British institutions, and more so than just like critiquing, you know, the state of Britain. So Starmer's trying to like make sure he's gaining a hearing and being seen as in the mainstream. The question then is, because I think they have distanced themselves from the era of Corbyn, what are they going to do with that? Are they going to be able to substantively tell a different story of Britishness and get to bed in, defeat the right-wing version of Britishness for a period that they can remake the parameters of Britain in a way that is a better society? Because otherwise, the Labour historically at a disadvantage on this, and will, if they fail politically, if they fail economically, if they fail in terms of constitutional reform, that right-wing version, which is not going away at the moment, will gather force and come back with a vengeance.
All those three moments in the past when Labour managed to kind of successfully attach itself to national symbols and traditional patriotism, straight after the Second World War, early Wilson, early Blair, they were all periods of economic and social optimism. And we are going into whatever the opposite of that is right now. Can you attach yourself to traditional patriotism when the environment around you is crumbling?
Again, that's a big question. You're right. 45, 64 and 97 are moments of political optimism. And I mean, there was an economic crisis in 1945 and 64. Certainly 64 was nothing like the scale we've seen now. To remake, tell a different story of Britain, you have to connect it to reality. And that means an economy that works for most people. That means a society where we don't have inequalities we have, and our political institutions serve us better. Now, that is a tough ask for Labour to do, and at the same time, inhabit a terrain that they have never successfully inhabited for a long enough period. I think, A, it's possible, in a very small way, I think it's possible, and I hope it's possible, because the traditional version of Britain, the Tory reactionary version of Britain, is crumbling before our eyes, has failed us, obviously. But yet at the same time, there is, because of that, there's even more a virulent right-wing version gathering in terms like the Brexit Party, Farage, and, you know, the fringes of the Tory party. And I think, I do feel that in a way, this is a last gasp salon for kind of British Labour and Britishness. They have a window where they could work this out, where it could turn out to be that they can make effective change that tells a different story of Britain. But if they don't, then the seismic differences and fault lines in Britain will, I think, just gather, aided by a virulent right-wing Toryism. I think that could be rather unpleasant for lots of us, but it's a possible scenario, given just the crises that a Labour government is going to inherit. And then the fact there is, you know, a version of Britain being told that is very, very confident in its story and has obviously significant media outlets, power, money, etc., and platforms to tell it.
I want to ask you about the Cross of St. George, which we mentioned a little bit earlier, the mass engagement with flags or the symbolism of flags. It seems that the kind of connection with the Cross of St. George has become, you know, hotter, shall we say, more passionate as engagement with the Union Jack has kind of become cooler. You saw the massive kickoff when Nike just did a fairly standard clothing manufacturer's tweak of the colours of the Cross of St. George. This provoked a huge backlash in the press first before the general public. They would, general public were very much goaded into it, but did react hugely. And you compare that to when the union flag was changed for the 2012 Olympics and the red was taken out of it completely. It was different shades of blue. You could say erasing England, but there wasn't a peep. Okay, it was a different time. It's before Brexit. But the fact that people take the, or English people are now so incredibly, or many of them, incredibly protective of the Cross of St. George, and perhaps less of the Union Jack itself. What do you think that says?
Well, I think we're living through an age, if you think of what we're going through in terms of the sheer, you know, disruption in society economically and socially, and then we have something called the culture wars, which, whether you agree they're culture wars or not, we are in a society where, in an age across the West, where lots of things are more disputed that never used to be disputed. And there's a progressive and liberal and left critique of institutions and legacy of things like empire and slavery. And there's then a right-wing version of saying, like, you're constantly trying to revisit and dig up history and, you know, take our museums and tradition away from us. In an age like this, symbols really matter. And symbols like national flags are really contested. So when Nike come along and rebrand something that, you know, is what brands do, it becomes something that is played up in media platforms, played up by right-wing commentators, and becomes one of these contested issues. And I don't think it's very surprising, because there is something that can be called a culture war, and there is a right-wing weaponization and political of that, and there are in places some, you know, left-wingers and radicals who go too far on some of this in terms of how they, you know, understand empire or slavery, or, you know, taking down Edward Coulson's statue in Bristol and, you know, throwing it in the dock, etc., rather than going through due process. That offends some people sometimes as well. And, you know, there's Oxford colleges and renaming and so on. So I don't think any of this is very surprising. And also, it ties into that not only do symbols matter, flags just really matter. Flags are something that are part of who we are as human beings. They are what define us into nation states. They're what define us into tribes. And we have an emotional relationship with them. So while there's a lot of, like, you know, framing this and weaponizing, it's not surprising in a way that also, like, flags really matter. And the rising salience of the English flag is clearly related to what's been going on in the United Kingdom the last 25 years, you know, the rise of the Scottish Parliament, Welsh Parliament, Northern Irish Assembly, and who speaks for England? Because at the moment, collectively, no one speaks for England. The only people that speak for England politically are, you know, rather sadly for some of us, the Westminster government, which is the UK Parliament. And so England has, as I was saying earlier, this ambivalent relationship between England and Britain, and that has become more problematic, basically. And some of us would like to live in a set of arrangements on this United Kingdom where England speaks as a modern, progressive, dare I say, even European nation that is comfortable with the different Englands that are there. And I would say in the Brexit debate, one of the things that happened, which led to Brexit, was that the right-wing version of England spoke for a majority of England and were kind of given that territory by a large part of the left and the Labour Party. And I think that was a major factor in Brexit. There are many Englands out there. There's many liberal, progressive, you know, inclusive Englands. And it was failed to be championed and represented, not just in Brexit, the referendum, I mean, but the long run into that. And I think with resulting disastrous consequences.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that, like, a lot of this happens in the world of popular newspapers and popular culture. And at the start of the 90s, I got into deep trouble by putting the Union Jack on the front of a rock and roll magazine. I used to be the editor of a monthly rock and roll magazine, and we you know, put Brett from Suede and the Union Jack, the beginning of Britpop, and got a lot of stick from a lot of other music journalists and some readers. And then within 18 months, Noel Gallagher's there with his Union Jack guitar, and Jerry Spice is there in a Union Jack frock. And apparently it all moved so quickly that that was fine by then. And I remember writing in that issue of the magazine that if people of goodwill won't give people their flag back and make it mean good things, then there are people of ill will who will do that and will offer them a bad bill of fare. And I don't think I've ever really been right about something like that before or since, but I really felt like I got something there.
I think you're right. I think you're 100% right. And I've always, like a lot of people coming from the left, I have had an ambivalent relationship with the Union Jack through my life. But one is, and I've had an ambivalent relationship with the idea of Britain and the British state. But one of the things I think about this is that I've never felt in my adult life politically British, but I feel culturally British, and I feel proud of lots of the things, and I feel just great honour and privilege to have lived through some of the great things that have happened about cultural Britishness and indeed cultural Englishness. And I'm talking about post-punk, did the flowering of indie music in the 80s, lots of brilliant English writers and artists, and I feel an identification with them in terms of English stroke British. And I've always felt that whatever happens to the United Kingdom, there will be a cultural realm in which we engage with each other and identify as British in some way. I've always felt that we are, the shared relationships that we have across these isles will continue in some form, irrespective of the political arrangements we have. And I think that would be something that would aid a debate about how we relate to the flag, how we relate to our various identities on these islands. And indeed, to the point about England, can England ever, does it want to speak as a modern, progressive, inclusive nation? Or is it constrained in the current set of arrangements, which clearly work for the forces of the right, for inequality, against, I would say, the interests of the majority of people of England, let alone the majority of people of the United Kingdom?
One of my favourite Union Jacks is the one that's the reggae pirate station Dread Broadcasting Corporation used to do. And it's the Union Jack, but it's red, gold and green. And I thought, that's a good look. Jerry Hassan, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you. It's been really quite inspiring, actually. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The book, The People's Flag and the Union Jack, An Alternative History of Britain and the Labour Party, is available now. Remember, listeners, the Podmasters National Podcast Service is free at the point of use, but we have to fund it somehow and money is getting tighter. So if you can spare the price of half a pint a month, then please consider using it to support our work. Search Patreon Bunker Podcast or follow the link in the show notes to find out how you can help keep the Bunker in business. I've been Andrew Harrison. This has been The Bunker. We'll see you next time.
Hello, I'm Roz Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Roz Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters Group Editor Andrew Harrison. The producer was Eliza Davis Beard, the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey, and the managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.